Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for joining us for this Federalist Society Zoom event. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Matthew Fernholz, and I am the chapter president of the Milwaukee Lawyers Chapter of the Federalist Society. We're delighted to be joined this afternoon by Don Dougherty, who should be familiar to those of you who are involved in our chapter. Don was previously chapter president, and we're excited to have him here this afternoon to talk about some recent trends at the Supreme Court. A few programming notes before we start. You can submit questions to me during the Zoom event. Don is going to speak for approximately 20 minutes, give a quick summary. I'm going to do some question and answer with him as well, and then I will review the questions that have been submitted. We'll try to get to all of them, but can't promise we will. Please be submitting questions throughout the event, and I'll take them in the order that they're received. I also want to note that tomorrow we will open up our registration for the Wisconsin Statewide Conference. That's an event that our chapter is doing in partnership with the Madison Lawyers Chapter. The event is being changed a bit due to coronavirus. We are still having our panelists, but those will be moved to Zoom events on Tuesday, September 1st, and Wednesday, September 2nd. The first one will be on election law changes in Wisconsin. The second panel will be a debate on nationwide injunctions. And our reception will still be Thursday, September 3rd with Senator Ron Johnson. That will be in the late afternoon. So please be sure to watch for the invitation and registration. I'll introduce Don briefly and then open it up to him. As I said, Don Dougherty has been involved in our chapter for a number of years. He's also had a significant career and experience in Wisconsin's legal system. He's practiced law for over 30 years at the trial and appellate level at some of the largest and most distinguished firms in Wisconsin. He is a graduate of the University of Virginia and Northwestern Law School, and he's clerked for Judge Roger Miner of the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. In addition, Mr. Dougherty has been involved in the Governor Walker's Judicial Selection Advisory Committee, and he's also president of the Eastern District of Wisconsin Bar Association. So with that, Don, I'll open it up to you. And if you want to start by giving a summary of some of the recent significant cases at the Supreme Court this last term and talk about some of the general trends, and I may chime in if you don't mind, if I have questions as you're giving your explanation.
Sure, great. And thanks for that warm introduction, Mac. It's good to be here with everybody this afternoon. I appreciate it. I'm going to really focus on four trends that have emerged over the Supreme Court's last four terms today. But first, a little bit about the genesis of this teleform. For each of the past 3 years, I've reviewed for the Federalist Society books that are published by the UPenn Press as part of their American Justice series. And that is an annual analysis of the just completed Supreme Court term. So at the beginning of this year, in the era which since the onset of the COVID pandemic has become known as the before time, during the before time, one of my colleagues at Will suggested that these reviews might make for a good presentation in the spring. And I thought this was a great idea, given that I had read all the major cases from the previous October 2016, 2017, and 2018 terms, so it wouldn't require, you know, a lot of additional work for me. But of course, with the onset of the pandemic, we really, I couldn't get my act together until after the October 2019 term ended in early July. And although I'm happy that we could pull it together for today, it has meant that I've had to do a lot of additional reading to get caught up. The October 2019 just completed term, so that I can try to speak intelligently about them for you. This is especially true because the October 2019 term, I had more blockbuster cases than the three previous ones. Even though largely a result of the COVID situation, the court decided only 56 cases, which is the fewest cases decided since the Civil War. Now, normally the Roberts Court decides fewer cases than the predecessor Rehnquist, Berger, and Warren courts, roughly 70 some odd cases a year. But 56 is very small, very small number. And yet, as I said, there's been more blockbuster type cases that came out of the just completed term than the three previous ones. So in any event, what I'll be talking about today, the trends I want to focus on, I don't claim that any of my observations are particularly original, but and some of them are derivative of other commentators, certainly, folks who are more steeped in the day-to-day Supreme Court goings-on, you know, the journalists and folks who actually live and are paid to cover the court. But nonetheless, I think these trends are clear ones that are recognized, and they are worth us thinking about. So the first trend I want to touch on is certainly, I think, a positive one, namely the rise of textualism and originalism as the preferred approach to constitutional and statutory interpretation. And not only did Justice Kagan state at her confirmation hearing in 2010 that we are all originalists now, but cases from recent terms demonstrate that most of the justices actually seem to be playing on that same playing field. Relatedly, the notion of a living constitution, although not entirely dead, seems at least for the time being to have gone underground, and very few justices seem to tout it as their methodology. So with regard to textualism, a recent trend of the trend towards that is the majority opinion in Celia Law versus Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which just came out earlier this year in the October 2019 term. There, Chief Justice Roberts wrote for the majority that insulating the director of the CFPB from termination at will was an unconstitutional violation of the separation of powers. Now, it's not surprising, of course, that his majority opinion closely reviewed the text of the removal clause in Article 2, Section 2, as well as original publicly understood meaning. But Justice Kagan's dissent also went through a very robust historical analysis of the text, the constitutional text, and the president's removal power, as well as related constitutional provisions. So clearly, in Celia, they were all playing on the same playing field, which of textualism and originalism, which I think is good. Another example from the October 2018 term is the New Prime case, sort of a lower profile case, but there a unanimous court held that an independent contractor for a trucking company could pursue a class action on behalf of himself and other drivers for allegedly improper paycheck deductions, notwithstanding the fact that in their contracts, they weren't employees, but in their contracts with the trucking company, there were arbitration provisions, and the Federal Arbitration Act excluded from its scope contracts of employment of workers engaged in interstate commerce. So that was the statutory phrase that was focused on by Justice Gorsuch in his majority opinion. Of course, you know, he did the normal, entirely appropriate, and I think the best way of deciding these kinds of things. He looked at the usage of the word employment. At the time, the FAA was passed in 1925. He cited contemporaneous dictionaries and statutes, and he concluded that that the exception in the FAA was broad enough to encompass work agreements involving independent contractors, like the plaintiffs there. So, of course, that's not particularly surprising from Gorsuch, who was a textualist to a fault, as we'll talk about soon. But also in that case, Justice Ginsburg, not considered to be a textualist normally, she concurred, and she wrote, looking to the period of enactment to gauge statutory meaning ordinarily fosters fidelity to the regime Congress established. That's, you know, that's sort of the original meaning kind of approach in reviewing text, statutory text. So she was on board as well. She did insist, I should say in her concurrence, that there are certain types of statutes like the Sherman Antitrust Act, Securities Act, the RICO, that she said, her words were, that they contain words that can enlarge or contract their scope as other changes in law or in the world require their application to new instances or make old applications anachronistic. So she wasn't entirely on board with textualism, or at least she gave herself that wiggle room, certainly. But again, largely they were all playing on the same playing field in the new prime case.
Don, do you mind if I jump in with a question for you on this? Do you see any examples in the last four terms you reviewed of someone who is espousing living constitutionalism, or is that pretty much evaporated?
Yeah, no, I mean, again, I think, and I'll talk about here, I think in the Bostock case, I'll talk about here in a moment, you know, I think that folks, sort of the liberal justices, and liberal is kind of a shorthand word, liberal conservative, I know they're sort of shorthand and simplistic kind of terms, but, you know, they're the way of trying to understand this. But I do think that, and notwithstanding what I do think is the ascension of the textualist approach, there are results that are consistent with living constitutionalism, and I'm going to talk about those here and now, because other recent cases like Bostock, they also point to a different aspect of textualism, namely that it does not inexorably lead to a single result. That is, you know, all textualists will not necessarily agree. And also, too, a textualist result would not necessarily be a conservative result as a policy matter. The statute is written broadly, if it's written with, you know, sort of, progressive language, or wants to achieve, broad social change. Of course, there's obviously, constitutional restrictions on that, too. But again, textualism should go, if properly done, where the language of the text takes it, regardless of whether the outcome is conservative, quote-unquote, or liberal, quote-unquote, as a policy matter. And again, the most notable, notorious example of this is the Bostock Title VII case that just came down. There, as you all may know, the issue was whether Title VII prohibited termination of employees based on sexual orientation or their transgender status. And the specific statutory phrase at issue made it unlawful to, quote unquote, discriminate against an employee because of sex. So that's what the court was looking at. Justice Gorsuch reached his conclusion that sexual orientation and transgender status were protected by Title VII through a textualist approach. And there, you know, kind of we were hinting at or talking about a moment ago, Matt, the four liberal justices signed on to his opinion. His textualist, or at least purportedly textualist opinion, and they didn't write separately to concur or to invoke living constitutionalism or anything like that, and they were satisfied to rest on his, again, purportedly textualist interpretation. But nobody does the kind of thing that Justice Posner did in the Hively case from the Seventh Circuit, which you all may be familiar with, which dealt with the same issue and reached the same result as the majority in Bostock, namely that Title VII protects against discrimination based on sexual orientation or transgender status. Judge Posner, as is his wont, said, yeah, basically, judges can update statutes whenever they want. I'm going to update this one because things have changed, you know, since it was enacted in the mid-60s. Nobody has been that candid about it, but certainly a lot of the results recently, are consistent with that. Now, you know, of course, Bostock's interpretation of the relevant statutory language in Title VII, that is, whether, you know, you're discriminating against an employee because of sex, it clearly doesn't comport with the phrase's ordinary meaning, you know, either at the time Title VII was passed in the mid-60s or today. I mean, discrimination because of sex, excuse me, is universally understood to be something different from discrimination because of sexual orientation or discrimination because of gender identity. For example, the recent biopic of Justice Ginsburg was called On the Basis of Sex and dealt with discrimination based on one's biological sex. There was no thought in that movie that on the basis of sex meant on the basis of sexual orientation or on the basis of transgender status. So, you know, again, at the time that Title VII was passed and today, nobody thinks of sex discrimination as being something that is the same as sexual orientation discrimination or gender identity discrimination. But in his analysis in Bostock, Gorsuch did engage in kind of a literary deconstructionism. He broke the statute's language down into individual words, then he kind of played different word games with those words, the individual words, and really didn't consider the phrases, consider them in context. So I think, again, I have no doubt that he thinks that he engaged in proper textualism, but Bostock has been fairly criticized really as halfway textualism. Professor Barnett at Georgetown and Professor Josh Blackman of Cato have called it that. And again, I don't think it was a proper result. I don't think it was a proper application of textualism. But there is no doubt that Justice Gorsuch sincerely believed he properly applied textualism. And I guess if nothing else, Bostock shows that there can be serious disagreement about the correct textualist interpretation. So I think we sort of, I don't want to say won the war as the proper methodology, but just winning the proper methodology doesn't get you to the right results necessarily, or what we think are the right results. And there can be misapplications of any methodology. And I think that occurred in Bostock. Now, as textualism gains traction as a methodology, different schools of thought about it are emerging. There is, and I wasn't familiar with these terms until recently, but there is something called first-generation textualism. And that's sort of the pre-Scalia approach, which you look at the text, but also you kind of look at legislative history. New textualism is the term given to basically what Justice Scalia wrought, what he set out and argued for successfully. But I do think, and we were talking about this before we got on this online here, but I think there will be, in fact, a textualism 3.0 coming down the pike at some point. And I think that's going to likely include the corpus linguistics tool, which has cast doubt on whether dictionaries are, in fact, the best sources for determining original public meaning. If you don't know about corpus linguistics, there was actually a teleform that we did for FedSoc. I moderated it just a week or two ago. And I think that's something that judges are interested in that, and practitioners, and that's a different way of determining original public meaning. So I would try to familiarize yourself with corpus linguistics, because I do think that will be part of sort of a textualism 3.0 movement that we may be seeing. Another issue that has also arisen in the context of textualism is whether a textualist decision should take non-textualist precedent into account. And that occurred in Bostock. Specifically, Justice Gorsuch relied on some Title VII cases that really did not closely hew to the language of Title VII. So there's a whole thought that maybe textualists, leaving apart whether those cases should be overturned or not, whether they should even be relied on in a textualist approach. But, at the least, again, this is a positive trend. Textualism does offer an objective external source against which interpretations, legal interpretations can be measured and judicial decisions evaluated. That objective external source is, of course, the legal text, but it's better than, and of course, it doesn't necessarily lead to a single result or even a conservative result, but it is much more preferable and consistent with our democratic republic than relying on a judge's own sense of, what the current, national zeitgeist is, which I think was a lot of what was passing, at least expressly for analysis in the past. Now, again, maybe living constitutionalism and this kind of stuff is merely underground. I think to some extent it is, but I'll take the victory such as it is, and I can't as I can. Now, a second trend that I wanted to point to is that even with a clear conservative majority, since Justice Kavanaugh was confirmed in fall of 2018, the Chief Justice does remain a judicial minimalist. And he preferred that any change in the law occurs only incrementally. So the conservative revolution that many of us wanted and that liberals have been warning about ever since Donald Trump was elected has not fully occurred. It has occurred much less than many of us had hoped. And that is because, I think, of the Chief Justice's minimalistic approach. An example would be, again, the Celia case, the CFPB case that I mentioned a moment ago. In that case, Chief Justice Roberts could have declared that the entire CFPB was unconstitutional, the entire Bureau was unconstitutional, but instead, and without some controversy, he concluded that he could sever off the offensive for-cause termination portion of the termination provision for the director. And so he's, was able to save the balance of the statute. And so the CFPB, remains in place. That's a minimalist, incrementalist kind of approach that, again, conservatives would have probably preferred he had been bolder, and it might have been more legally correct not to sever off the offensive termination provision, I should say, but just take the whole thing down. And, of course, this reminds all of us of the Sebelius case, the Obamacare case from a number of years ago, where, Chief Justice Roberts deferred to the political branches. That's, consistent with conservative thoughts of judicial restraint. But he got there by, you know, resorting to a statutory misconstruction, I think, of the ACC, as well as, you know, a misuse of the term, the word tax that nobody really had ever thought of before that. So, you know, that's another example of minimalism and perhaps sort of bending over backwards in order to maintain the status quo and to defer to the political branches, which, again, you know, judicial restraint, that's usually a conservative kind of thing. Usually we say judges shouldn't be making law. They shouldn't be, they should be, you know, deferring to the political branches. But, you know, you can't do that through misconstruction of the very statute at issue, which is, I think, what occurred in Sebelius.
A question for you, Don, on that. We know the Chief Justice is comfortable overruling precedent. He's comfortable voting to strike down statutes. Now, in the recent terms, he seems to be more cautious. And there's some theory on the left that say, well, no, Roberts is not really moving in a more progressive direction. He's playing this long game where he's trying to preserve the court's institutional integrity, but his goal is to eventually move the court in a more textualist or originalist direction. Do you believe that the Chief Justice is sometimes being coy because he has this long-term plan in place, or do you think that he's changed his judicial outlook in the 15 years he's been on the court?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's hard to say. I mean, I think he is fundamentally conservative, but again, you know, part of fundamental conservatism in looking at the structure, the constitutional structure of government, is that, you know, the judiciary defers to the political branches, but they've also got to be engaged, I think, more so than perhaps he has. Now, you know, I'd love it if, you know, he's playing a long game. I mean, I don't know whether he is or not. I hope he is. But at the same time, too, you know, as John Maynard Keynes said, in the long run, we all die. So, you know, I don't hope he's not waiting too long. He is extremely smart, to say the least. Again, whether he's being sort of too clever by half in some of his moves, where he, you know, reaches one outcome but then kind of leaves an Easter egg of sorts in the opinion for conservatives or the losing side to look to, you know, I don't know. I think, you know, I guess probably, you know, I do think that some, you know, I kind of buy in, or, you know, not, I don't reject the notion that he's playing, like, you know, three-level chess while the rest of us are playing checkers and that kind of thing. But sometimes, too, you know, again, you can be too clever by half or be too concerned with long-term strategy. And I kind of do prefer Justice Thomas's approach of just sort of looking at the case in front of you. Strategic considerations are not unimportant. But, you know, again, I hopefully he's not waiting too long because again, in the long run, we all do meet our maker, I guess. So.
Well, that's a second Keynes reference from you. We're all textualists now, and in the long run, we're all dead.
But part, you know, part of this is, I think, you can look back to his confirmation hearings, you know, his well-known baseball umpire metaphor. And he talked about calling balls and strikes, and everybody remembers that. And then people said, oh, it's not that easy and blah, blah, blah. But I think the real point of that exchange, if you go back and read the transcript, was, you know, what he said there was nobody goes to a baseball game to watch the umpire. And I think this is right. I mean, I think he believes correctly that the real action in federal government should occur in the political branches. The judiciary should not be where so many of our important national issues are decided, and the role of the judges, role of judges, is much more limited. It's frankly much more boring. They should simply interpret without drama the law that encodes policy decisions that are made in the political branches. He may be changing expectations about what the judiciary will resolve. I think the court, or at least he specifically, are trying to channel certain matters, divert them to the political branches or to the states for resolution. As I mentioned at the outset, the effort to direct certain issues away from the Supreme Court may be reflected in low number, historically low number of cases the Roberts Court hears compared to prior courts. And a specific example I can talk about of his judicial minimalism, I think, is in the political gerrymandering cases. After years of teasing, particularly through Justice Kennedy, excuse me, sorry about that, teasing that the Supreme Court might involve itself in evaluations of whether redistricting maps are unconstitutionally politically gerrymandered, Supreme Court did make clear in Gill v. Whitford in the 2017 term and Rucho v. Common Cause in the 2018 current term that federal courts would not decide that issue. Rucho involved, as you probably know, a challenge by Democrats to a map of North Carolina's congressional district that was drawn by Republican state lawmakers. And for the 5-4 majority, Roberts wrote that political gerrymandering claims present a non-justiciable political question. This isn't for courts to decide. He wrote that there are no legal standards discernible in the Constitution for making judgments as to whether political power is apportioned fairly or whether political decisions are too political. And he said, let alone their limited or precise standards that are clear, manageable, and politically neutral. And thus, again, going forward, political gerrymandering will be fought out at the state levels, and any litigation is going to be, will occur in the state courts. So that's an example, again, of minimalism, but I think in a proper kind of way, it's saying this isn't for the federal courts. Not everything is a federal case. And for too long, I think we've grown accustomed in our society to looking to the federal courts for relief, so on both sides of the aisle. Of course, now, ironically, now the Supreme Court is tilting certainly to the right, liberals are finding themselves in agreement with conservatives about the proper limited role of the judiciary. One of the books I reviewed regarding the 2018 term, it was a writer for Slate, a guy named Mark Stern, who was, avowedly far left progressive. But he said in the book, he kind of claimed, he asked rhetorically, he said, is it healthy in a democracy for so many important issues to be settled by 9 lawyers in Washington, D.C.? Well, it's like, of course not. No kidding. Where you been? I mean, we've all been saying this on the conservative side for many, many years. And so I've seen a lot of liberals talk about how, the court's role should be more limited and you should look to the political branches. And again, welcome aboard. We've been saying that for years. Folks in the Federal Society and other conservatives.
I did sense some irony in the argument on the political gerrymandering side from litigants bringing the case that, this is our Supreme Court is terrible. It's moved to the right, but let's let them draw the districts of all 50 states.
Yeah. And we can talk about this later. I mean, the notion, that the court is politicized, well, whoever loses, a case that has political implications is going to say the court's being political, whoever loses, if it's the right Republicans or Democrats. So, a lot of this talk about the court being too political, I think, is just from folks, it depends on whose ox is being gored. But if your ox is being gored, you're going to say they're being overly political when really you're just unhappy about the result, which isn't to say that the Supreme Court needn't be careful about its analysis and needn't be careful that it does stick to, real textual kinds of objective kind of analyses. But, I think there was a complaint that after there was some case that Gorsuch had written and Mitch McConnell tweeted out something, a photograph of him and McConnell and Gorsuch shaking hands and that kind of thing and sort of, beating his own chest, Mitch McConnell, about how he'd gotten Gorsuch on the court, and Gorsuch had written this conservative opinion, and it's not Gorsuch's fault. I mean, politicians are going to politic. That fish are going to swim. Politicians are going to politic, but justices, can't get caught up in that. And to the extent they do, then they do risk becoming a political, overly political institution. As I was saying, many conservatives, are deeply and reasonably disappointed by Justice Roberts' judicial restraint, which they see as timidity, I think. Jonathan Adler, who's a professor at Case Western, Ramanish Panaru, who's a writer at National Review, have recently written about this. They recognize that Roberts wants to avoid disruption, be a judicial conservative or show judicial restraint. He also wants to protect his branch. I mean, his branch is not just the least dangerous, but it's the weakest. It doesn't have the power of the purse or the sword. And so there is some protecting of his own institutional credibility just because in order to have any effect, they have to be credible. Maybe there's some truth toward this, but, I think many of us say that we may in fact need, some bolder action from the Chief Justice who is willing to engage in order to protect constitutional rights, the constitutional structure. And that may not be, I don't think in some cases, certainly that's what we're getting. Again, his caution, Chief Justice Roberts' caution, is consistent with his concern about preserving the institutional integrity. He wants to avoid criticism of being politicized. But, you know, again, deciding certain cases in order to avoid, to reach politically correct results or to avoid backlash from certain segments of the population, that's not going to help with institutional credibility. That just might appease one side for the short term. I will say, you know, I mean, and this has just come out, in the eyes of the public, the Supreme Court amongst, you know, the three branches is perceived by the public to be much, much more credible, trustworthy, all those kinds of things. I mean, you know, they're I forget the exact percentages. There's one that just came out after the most recent term, but, you know, I mean, the president and Congress, I think the president's at 37% or something as an executive branch, as an institution that can be trusted. Congress was in the teens. And I don't, you know, the Supreme Court was hovering around 50 or something percent public, you know, trust. So there's something to be said for that, I think. In any event, let me move now to the third trend that I want to talk about. And I think that's the appearance of a number of sort of anomalous cases that have begun appearing since early 2018, which coincidentally is when Donald Trump became president. And obviously I think there's a cause and effect there. This seems to be particularly true in administrative agency cases. Let's look to this term's DACA case, the Department of Homeland Security versus University of California Regents, a 5-4 decision in which Justice Roberts and the court blocked President Trump's repeal of President Obama's executive order that created the 2012 Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. That program halted the deportation of aliens who had been brought to the U.S. legally and when they were children, and it did so on the basis of prosecutorial discretion, which I think is stretching the notion of prosecutorial discretion beyond what it really means. But in the DACA case, though, Chief Justice Roberts wrote that even if Obama's executive order was illegal, which the Attorney General Sessions had said it was a legal, you know, order, Trump's DHS, Department of Homeland Security, still had to go through this onerous, long, you know, time-consuming procedure under the American Administrative Procedure Act in order to rescind it, even though, you know, Roberts didn't really say, I mean, he didn't take issue with the fact that DACA was illegal, the DACA program was illegal. But even without that, he still said the Trump administration had to go through all of the APA process. And so the case was remanded for additional efforts by DHS to comply with the APA. So this is kind of a new approach, a new legal interpretation, and it may actually allow president to effectively bind his or her successor through executive orders if it's something that's not just sui generis for Trump. But another example of sort of Trumpian-based jurisprudence is last term census case, Department of Commerce versus New York. The issue was whether the administration could add a citizenship question to the 2020 census. And the Chief Justice wrote the majority opinion in that case. And most of his decision was devoted to the conclusion that he and the four other justices reached that the citizenship question was not unconstitutional, was not arbitrary or capricious under the APA. He wrote that the Department of Commerce, which conducts the census, has broad authority over the census and may collect demographic information as it sees fit. Wrote that the Secretary of the Department of Commerce was permitted to make policy choices within the range of reasonable options, and judges should not be second-guessing the Secretary's weighing of risks and benefits. And I think this is all pretty much straightforward administrative law. You know, you look at the record, administrative record, you don't look behind it to motives, and you defer to administrative agencies. So that seemed pretty straightforward. But then in the latter portion of that decision, Roberts, you know, lost the four conservatives and was joined then by the four liberals because he wrote that the APA required the secretary to disclose the basis for its action, which is pushing it, and that its sole stated reason for including the citizenship question, he said, seems to have been contrived, so he wouldn't defer to it, writing that if judicial review is to be more than an empty ritual, must demand something better than the explanation offered for the action taken in this case. And so, like with DHS and the DACA case, he remanded the case for the Department of Commerce to try again to justify inclusion of the citizenship question. Now, in both DACA case and the census case, I think it's pretty clear the deference that's ordinarily given to an administrative agency's interpretation was not accorded to administrative agency during the Trump administration. So I guess my last thought on this trend is, you know, it'll be interesting to see. We'll have to wait and see, but it would be very unfortunate if some of the justices simply revert to sort of the pre-Trumpian jurisprudence regarding administrative agencies and other matters, whatever point in time his presidency ends, and they don't treat exercise of discretion by, for example, the Kamala Harris administration. They treat that differently than they treated those of the Trump administration. I guess only time will tell with regard to that. Now, my final trend centers on collisions between secular society and the religion clauses, and these will continue to multiply. Dean Erwin Chemerinsky of Cal Berkeley, who very liberal but extremely bright, and I've gotten to know him a little bit, a wonderful man, but just and much smarter than I'll ever be, but I think wrong in a lot of this stuff. In any event, he's complained that from his point of view, the Roberts Court is increasing the importance of the free exercise clause at the expense of the establishment clause. Now, I think there are many of us who would say that what the Supreme Court really is doing is simply restoring those two clauses to the way that they were originally understood, and that doing so in that area is, in fact, an act of proper judicial engagement that, you know, that we do like, you know, conservatives engaging with the law and pushing back. So that does sort of reach the what was intended to be the original balance, original understanding by the time of the enactment of the Bill of Rights in this case. This more robust free exercise clause that I think we've been seeing in the recent terms, ironically, may have been presaged by Justice Kennedy's 2015 opinion in Obergefell. There, of course, as everyone knows, the court found a constitutional right for same-sex couples to marry. But in that decision, Kennedy emphasized that the First Amendment ensures that religious persons are given proper protection as they seek to teach the principles that are so fulfilling and so central to their lives and faiths, and to their own deep aspirations to continue the family structure they have long revered. So he wanted to make sure that, notwithstanding the ruling, that there was proper protection for people of faith, and he pointed to the free exercise clause in that. You know, he had this sort of purple prose in the quote that I, you know, read to you. I mean, this sort of sweet mystery of life, legal reasoning, that he often engages in, which is, you know, really kind of a strange legal analysis or hard to really get your head around. But the bottom line point he was making was well taken. And I think the concern regarding protecting the right to free exercise does explain his vote in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case from just a couple of terms ago, which surprised a lot of people. Actually, in his last term, on the bench, Justice Kennedy, actually, his votes were much more conservative than people had expected. But in any event, yeah, Masterpiece Cake Shop, as you know, was an effort to compel a baker to make bakery to make a cake for a same-sex couple, where it would have gone against the sincere and strongly held religious convictions of the baker. And the court held, with Justice Kennedy's vote, that this violated his constitutional rights of free exercise. The concern for free exercise is especially seen in cases at the very, very end of the most recent term. Those cases, the Espinoza case, Full Sisters of the Poor case, Guadalupe School case. I won't get into those in much detail, but other than the note that Espinoza did strike down Montana's Blaine Amendment, which was an amendment that many states have and is firmly rooted in anti-Catholic bigotry, and so that was struck down as under free exercise concerns. So those free exercise cases that came after at the end of the term was much relief for conservatives, because Josh Blackman, Professor Blackman of Cato, had called it June Blue June, because You know, we've had Bostock and DACA and the June medical abortion case. So that was some relief, and I think that's another trend that we're going to see more and more. I also know, too, that since Blue June, in fact, Second Circuit recently cited Espinoza in striking down the Blaine Amendment in Vermont, which was prohibiting public funds going to religious schools. So that's I think, a welcome development for many of us. I think those are kind of, you know, the highlights I'd like to hit, Matt. I don't know if you have want to have some questions for me in addition.
I do. Well, thanks, Don. That was terrific. First, I just want to send a reminder to our audience that you can send questions directly to Don using the Q&A feature. I'll have a few questions for you, Don, as well, and then open it up to the audience. I want to pick up where you left off on your fourth trend, and the clash between Establishment Clause, Free Exercise Clause. Religious liberty has been on an incredible winning streak at the Supreme Court. And contrary, or perhaps a corollary, gay rights have been on an incredible winning streak at the Supreme Court as well. And so I've seen some commentators have this speculation that, well, Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kagan, they've decided the court can solve the culture war by protecting religious liberty and conscience objections and protecting gay rights. And this is the path we're going to take. When you mentioned the language from Obergefell, a lot of people, including me, just cast that aside and thought it was a throwaway line. But it seems to be a bit prescient 5 years later. So do you make anything, this is a bit of an insider baseball question, do you make anything of that theory of how the Supreme Court is going about addressing religious liberty on the one hand and individual gay rights cases on the other hand?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's speculation, but it's interesting speculation. I don't have any, I'm not aware of any sort of, evidence of internal, emails between Justice, Kagan and Chief Justice Roberts, and any texts they've agreed to this. Maybe there's some sort of tacit agreement. It's hard to say, but I guess I would say I don't think anything like sort of the overt vote trading and soliciting by Justice William Brennan that was recounted in the Brethren, I don't think that's going on. And I think even actually some of that was recounted by, I think it was Woodward who wrote that book. People are skeptical about the veracity of all of that. So I don't think, it's anything explicit. It's an explanation. We'll have to see how things play out. There are some additional free exercise cases coming up. That'll be interesting. We can talk about. Kagan and Roberts certainly do seem very much alike. I mean, they do both wield a lot of control. They are affable people. They're brilliant. And they are very strategic thinking. They're also flexible on certain types of cases. The thought being they're flexible. They'll give in on one type of case, like on the Trinity Lutheran case, dealing with, playground coverings being allowed to go to religious schools, not just public schools. Justice Kagan was in the 7-2 majority there. And there's some other things where she's kind of done that. And, I don't know. Again, there's some kind of horse trading that was so notorious, and came out of the Brethren. I'm skeptical whether that ever actually occurred and is occurring now. But, it's an interesting theory.
Yeah, well, I raise it in light of the Bostock decision. I have a hard time believing had this issue come before the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals in, say, 2004, and Judge Roberts had been on that panel, I find it very difficult to imagine he would have voted the way he did at the U.S. Supreme Court on that issue.
Well, yeah, but again, too, he was, Bostock was, that was just Gorsuch's opinion. So even if, maybe Roberts did that in order to curry favor for some sort of future kind of thing. I don't know. I mean, again, all you have there, my memory serves, all you have is Gorsuch's, textual, quote unquote, analysis. And nobody else said anything in the majority, the 6-3 majority, but all the conservatives were, wrote separately and pretty much savage Gorsuch's approach.
I'm going to go to an audience question. Someone is asking, hasn't substantive due process become the living constitution approach?
You know, I don't, and again, I'm not sure if there's a specific case where substantive due process is being invoked by the justices. I can't think of one. Again, substantive due process is akin to, you know, living constitutionalism. I don't think people really rely on it expressly or explicitly. So, you know, again, and I may have missed something, but I do tend to read all, you know, many of the cases, certainly the major cases, and I don't recall substantive due process being invoked by any of the liberal justices as a way of getting to their kind of preferred progressive outcome.
Another audience question. There have been some recent leaks from the Supreme Court that highlight serious divisions. Do you make anything of them, and how Chief Justice Roberts fits in?
Yeah, and I know, again, Professor Blackmun has written on this extensively. And it, you know, and you know, I think he thinks, you know, the Chief Justice has to go ahead and figure out where the leaks are coming from and that kind of thing. The leaks, what I think the person is referring to is to the author Joan Biskupic, who, of course, her brother Steve was the U.S. attorney here in Wisconsin and a practitioner, criminal defense guy in the Milwaukee area. Joan Biskupic does have, seems to have very good traction, or, you know, good sources, I guess, at the Supreme Court, maybe better than most people. And certainly I think leaking is unseemly. I don't know if the justices themselves doing it or allowing their clerks to do it. You know, I don't know that Roberts can sort of reprimand people or completely stop it. And so, you know, we'll see. You know, and frankly, I think I've read a column kind of responding to Professor Blackmun and saying, you know, really kind of the stuff, the leaks that came out, they were, you know, kind of, you know, had some purient interest or, you know, some sort of, I mean, they're gossipy kind of interesting things, but at the end of the day, I do think, and a lot of this is just comparing the Supreme Court to the other branches. I mean, I think, you know, they are really the adults, you know, in the federal government, more so than, you know, the other branches. You know, I take Kagan at her word. I think it's true when she said, you know, she said in interviews that we all get along. You know, famously, Scalia and Ginsburg, you know, were close and, you know, went with their spouses to the opera together. And so I think, you know, that's usually kind of the way things operate. I mean, right, it's really brutal now. Yeah, that might, you know, be a concern. But I do think that to some extent, the Supreme Court is often kind of the calm, you know, in the storm swirling around it on Capitol Hill and at 1600 Pennsylvania.
Yeah, certainly you look at leaks coming out of the Trump White House, and I'd say the Supreme Court has pretty good plumbing by comparison.
Yeah, exactly. It's all relative. Yeah, it's all relative. So
we called this panel Recent Trends in the Roberts Court. This is a question I have. It's, of course, a bit of a misnomer because he's the Chief Justice, but he doesn't own the court. But we do have this unusual situation where the Chief Justice is the swing justice. And has a bit more control over, he has control over assignment of opinions, and he has control of the direction of the court. How do you believe the fact that the swing justice is the chief impacts the dynamics of the court?
Well, first of all, yeah, and I appreciate you pointing out, too, that, you know, I think I referred to earlier, you know, I was using conservative and liberal justices just kind of shorthand. And in the same way, too, the Roberts Court really is just a way to distinguish it from previous courts and really just a way of referring to certain, you know, composition of the courts. But at the same time, you know, he does wield a lot of power, and people believe that, you know, he has wield the power that he does have, which is primarily the ability to assign opinion writing when he's in the majority. With regard to Roberts being the swing vote, I think it's better than Kennedy being the swing vote. I mean, again, everything's well relative, and we'll see how things pan out. But I think Roberts has a more coherent jurisprudence. I think he is probably going to be more conservative than Kennedy, because that's what Kennedy used to be the swing vote. Now you have Roberts. I remember again Chemerinsky saying that after Kennedy retired, he thought there would be no swing vote. He thought it would be a block of five conservatives, including Roberts, and then four liberals. Well, much as some of us might have liked that, that's not the way it's turned out. The way Roberts votes, he will always win. In this last term, he was in the majority of every single major case. The only case he was not in the majority of that was major was the McGurk Indian law case, and that case probably will have the least real world impact of them. And people have noted he does assign a lot of the most important opinions to himself, because he wants to kind of thread the needle and achieve his incrementalism and all of that. Roberts says the swing vote. I guess I prefer him to Kennedy as a swing vote, but it remains to be seen how that's going to play out, since we've only had a single term with him as a swing vote.
There is a question regarding that Indian reservation rights case in Oklahoma and the significance of it. I know there were a lot of screaming headlines about Oklahoma is now over half an Indian reservation. Can you talk to the actual practical impact of that decision?
Yeah, well, I read the case. It's, and again, just to show you, hold on a second here. It's over here somewhere in my stack of stuff, McGirt.
This is all non-billable work, we have to point out, you're reading of this.
Well, I work not for profit, so I don't have to bill anymore. I'm no longer in private practice. But no, the practical effect may be less. I think in that case, that was Gorsuch. In his hypertextualism, it's also been referred to as a wooden textualism. So it's 5-4 with the four liberal justices and Gorsuch writing the majority opinion, and then Roberts and the others in the dissent. So again, I think in that case, Gorsuch elevated form over function or practicality. And I don't know exactly why this is, but I've read many places that, it's not like suddenly Oklahoma is going to become, half Indian land or not. There's a lot more to it than that. And I think a lot we worked out on the ground. So again, it's my understanding that it'll probably have not a huge amount of real world impact. We'll see.
We'll do one more audience question here and then wrap it up. Someone wants you to look into your crystal ball and assume composition of the court doesn't change, but Joe Biden wins the election, Democrats take control of the Senate, you have unified progressive control of government. What sort of issues do you believe are likely to be teed up in front of the Supreme Court in the coming years in that event?
Well, first of all, thanks. Very depressing.
At least the composition of the court is staying the same and not expanding to 15 justices.
I think that remains to be seen. But I think even on the left, that's kind of being decided to be not a good way to go. I mean, I think one thing that comes to mind right now is in the DACA case. I mean, basically in the DACA case, President Trump was effectively bound by what his predecessor had done through an executive order. And that's just not the way, the way things have normally been done. John Yoo, who is brilliant, has actually written a column. I think it sort of, struck fear into the hearts of folks on the left. That says, saying that basically Trump could issue executive orders you know, and if he loses, that would again effectively bind his successor, President Biden, if the court follows the same approach they did with regard to the Obama executive orders and how Trump had to rescind those, the hoops he had to jump through to do that. So that could be something that will come up. I would be certain that Trump, you know, would try to pass as many executive orders as he could without regard for, you know, their legality necessarily. And again, if the DACA case holds true, it would be a lot of work and it would take a long time for Biden to overturn those. So that would be one thing that comes to mind. Certainly, you know, you'll get, you know, Green New Deal types of things and expansions of, Medicaid and all that. So there'll be plenty. I think maybe then hopefully the conservatives on the court, including Justice Roberts, will bind together. They do all have a real sense of protecting the structure of the Constitution, or I should say of the federal government as set forth by the Constitution. Hopefully Roberts will, you know, sort of stand up to President Biden in the way that some believe he has felt the need to stand up in certain cases to President Trump.
Well, thanks, Don. I really appreciate your time this afternoon and all your insights. Again, a reminder to everyone, registration for the statewide conference should be coming out tomorrow. And we thank Don Dougherty, senior counsel at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Thanks for all the important work you do, Don, and thanks again for your insights today.
Thanks for having me, Matt. I really appreciate it. Take care.
Thank you.